a part of the show. Call in and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, welcome back to the final segment here on Monday Night Talk. And we've got a really cool segment coming up. We're going to be speaking with Alison Arngrim. She is on the line, best known to many folks. If you're somebody who remembers the TV series Little House on the Prairie, it was on air from 1974 to 1983. She played Nellie Olson, but she's gone on to other things. We're going to talk a little bit about Little House on the Prairie. We'll talk about her book. We'll talk about her one-person show and some of the causes, some of the things that she's working on, and also find out about some comedy that she does. Alison, welcome to Monday Night Talk here in the Boston area. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, and hi to my friend Howie Green and all my friends in Boston. Hello, and are you freezing? Are you totally freezing?
No, actually, if you asked me the question yesterday, yes, yes, we would have been totally freezing. But the gods have been good to us, and the mercury made it up to 30 degrees today.
Oh, nice. Well, we were quite warm, but now we're about to all drown and wash away into the ocean as we're having the like monsoon rain thing happen.
Well, but you're out on the West Coast, right?
Yeah, I'm in L.A., and you know that whole Tahunga Burn area thing where you had the fires?
Yes.
I'm right near that, so I'm okay, but I did just text a couple of neighbors and go, so are you evacuating? Because if the fire was right behind your house, yeah, you're going for a ride.
And have they finally, how well have they contained it, at least cornered that? Is it still going?
We got ours out, which was the Creek Fire was our official name. Ours went out. That won the Thomas Fire up north. That was crazy. That was just continuously smoldering like forever. But now, at least with the rains, we're like, yay, any vestige of fire is out. Of course, now the whole mudslide thing, the hill's going to come down, and what do you do?
God bless you. So why haven't you moved anywhere else, or is it California the place to be?
California is the place to be, and there's parts of California that don't catch fire. Yeah, you'd be more in the city. We're pretty good. We've really only had two massive fires in our area, and they really didn't endanger our house so much. We kind of got out a couple times. We bailed for a couple days because the smoke was bad. We're like, okay, well, we could stay. Our house is probably not going to burn. It'll stop over there, but do you really want to be here for the smoke and ash?
No.
So we've actually done very well in this neck of the woods, so I would totally stay here. There's areas of L.A. I mean, everyone loves Malibu, and they love those cliffs looking over the ocean. Yeah, I personally would probably not do it. It's dicey.
Okay, good to know. Looking
I have my limits, yes, in what I will live in, because I will go, yeah, that's really pretty. That's totally going to fall down.
So I have to, first off, if you get it, if we could, let's talk a little bit about your book, your one-person show, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch. I know that you have the audio version of your memoirs out now.
Yes.
How'd you put this together?
I'm very excited about the audio because it's so crazy. You know, now anyone who does a book, I mean, they're recording the audio before they're barely even done, you know, printing the book. But when Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, the full title being Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, How I Survived Nellie Olson and Learned to Love Being Hated, when that came out, audiobooks weren't as much the rage as they are this year. So I didn't do one right away. And now I'm like, well, wait, now everyone wants an audiobook. What am I, crazy? So we went into the studio and got an audiobook done. What happened was, I've been doing stand-up pretty much forever, since I was a teenager. And then in 2002, I started doing this one-woman show where I told all true stories, things from my life, and did a whole audience Q&A, became audience interactive, and I had video and photos. And it became this whole sort of one-woman show extravaganza. It was quite the hit. And that's when I really started touring heavily and performing in New York and in Boston and in P-Town and in New Jersey and in Philly and all those places. In fact, I'll be out your way again in the spring. And it became quite successful with that. And then I met a literary agent who said, is there a book to go with this show? Now, of course, I'd been sort of halfway working on a book for some time, and everyone had been begging me for a book. So I went, okay, well, now's the time. So I actually had some chat. He said, do you have like four chapters? And I'm like, yes, I actually do. So we talked. I showed him my chapters. And went, now you're talking. And wound up great deal with HarperCollins. And it came out. And I actually made it to the New York Times bestseller list, to my amazement.
Hot damn.
People really dug it. I got a New York Times bestseller. And the funny thing is it's still selling. I was told by people who apparently know these things, usually when you have a celebrity book, a memoir, you might do really, really well in the first couple of months. But after 3 or 4 months, they kind of go to the next celebrity memoir and you don't sell as many. Do you know my book is still selling? Every time I go on Amazon, there's like another bunch of reviews that people like just discovered it. It's kind of cool. And so I did the audiobook, and that's gone bananas. Pretty much everybody who bought the paperback or the hardcover now has the audio, and now people are getting the audio going, well, now I didn't have it before. I've heard the audio. Now I got to go buy the book. So it's just fabulous.
I mean, are you telling stories about what happened behind the scenes of this, or being somebody as a star? Because it sounds to me, you're talking about somebody who, I'm somebody who watches sports entertainment. Do you know what that is?
Vaguely.
Okay, so it's like watching wrestling, okay? The WWE. And if you either have a baby face who's the good guy or the heel.
Yes, yes, yes.
And so it sounds to me like you found a way to embrace being the heel.
Indeed, indeed. I was the bad guy. In fact, when I was a teenager during the height of the show and I was in like the Hollywood parade, people would boo and I would do that thing that people who were playing the bad guy in wrestling, you know, when they hold their hands over their head and go, yeah, rawr, to the chest. I was totally going, yes, okay, this is like being the bad guy in the wrestling thing. You are the mad bomber, terrible wrestler that everybody wants to be. So, yeah, I was that guy. I was the evil wrestler person everyone hated. Nelly. So, and I did. I totally went with that. Now, mind you, that parade where I was getting booed and I was going, yeah, bring it on, like I was the evil wrestler, I did have someone throw a McDonald's cup of orange soda at my head. And it was a direct hit. They had great aim. I was very impressed. And I was glad it wasn't a beer bottle, you know, because... people did react. They reacted that way. It was like, yay, Laura, boo, hiss. That was the booing, hissing thing. So I realized there was this phenomenon. I thought, I need to get in on this. And I saw that with the fans, there was this really emotional attachment to the characters and a lot like the wrestling situation with the characters and who you root for. So that was a part of it. And talking about that in my stand-up act, my book, about how people do that, what it's like to be the villain when you're basically generally actually a regular kind of nice person. And what do you do with that where millions of people think you're awful and you're not really? And how does that affect you? And at a young age, I mean, most wrestlers are adults. I was 12 right when I started the show, and people hated me. And what that was like growing up as a child star. And indeed, on the set of Little House, because people to this day are still fascinated with Little House on the Prairie. It's running in 140 countries. Our fan base is just out of control. I just signed a petition today, people demanding it be run on Netflix. it's a thing. And we're on our, like, fifth generation of viewers because we started in 1974, for God's sakes. But you'd never know. I mean, people are just mad for it, which, you know, fine by me. So I, you know, realized we had this fan base, and they wanted to know. They were fascinated, and they always had the same kind of questions. What was Michael Landon like?
Mm.
You know, because he was so funny. Here was this guy playing this very wholesome Charles Ingalls, but we see he drove a Ferrari and he was married and divorced. How did that work that he was so Hollywood? And this smoking, drinking, Ferrari-driving TV producer, yet here he was Charles Ingalls, and he created this incredibly wholesome, brilliant family show.
Right.
How on earth did that happen? And it's amazing. I mean, the guy was a genius, but yes, he was a bundle of contradictions and a fascinating person to know and to work for. So I talk about that. And I talk about the whole craziness of people hating me and the fact that Melissa Gilbert and I, who played Mortal Enemies, were actually best friends.
Oh, no kidding.
And then the girl who played Mary, who was so sweet, well, she didn't really like us. So instead of Laura and Mary being the darling little girls who were best friends and hating me, Laura and Nellie were best friends and we were afraid of Mary.
Oh, my.
Like, what? It was wonderfully crazy. We had all these interesting people on the show. I mean, we had all the famous guest stars.
Sure.
We had also our crew. Our hair and makeup people were so old. We had hair and makeup. We had Marilyn Monroe's makeup man and Betty Davis's hairdresser working on Little House on the Prairie.
Oh, my.
So we got stories. We were here with these young kids growing up in the business, and we were getting these stories about the pioneers and the original stars back in the day and all the dirt on everyone. So it was really fascinating place to work. So I do. I talk about all the crazy behind this. People want to know how on earth that episode where I go down the hill in the wheelchair, they're like, so there had to be a stunt girl for part of
right.
it. How much did you? They want to know. So I tell all. You name it, it's in there. And then my life in general. Yes, growing up as a child star is very difficult. And absolutely there's been problems, and I talk about everything. And people seem to like it.
I have to, but see, you grew through the show. Went from being that, you know, that villain to eventually getting married, and then
exactly.
of course you have the restaurant, and then they bring
right?
in another little blonde.
I had twins,
yes.
for heaven's sake.
Yes. And so what was that like? I mean, growing, and then, of course, everybody knows, it's been out long enough, you know, they blow up Walnut Grove because they're going to try to, you know,
right.
buy it. So, I mean, what was that like for the final scene where they blow it up?
Right, and that was very controversial. You know, there's a couple of actors, I know Charlotte, the woman who played Miss Beadle, she said, oh, I can't watch that episode. I have never watched that episode. I cannot look at it. And even some of the people who were there in filming it said, we didn't have to watch it because they filmed us all pushing the plunger and yep. getting ready to blow it up. And then, of course, they shot the explosions when we weren't there, when it was safe with right. no one around because it was quite dangerous. They said, oh, no, we couldn't bring ourselves to watch it. It was too upsetting. Because we grew up there. We literally, this would be like if they did an episode and gonna blow stuff up and said, we're going to your old elementary school in the playground where you spent all your time as a child. We're going to blow it up.
Right.
That's what it was like. And I got it, and I understood it, how Michael wanted to have the most outrageous ending he could think of. Something would really just end it all. Something where they wouldn't, because they recycle everything. You leave the sets there, they're going to shoot something else on them. We just couldn't leave that there. We had to, like, just take all the sets with us, make it all go away. And what in the hell do I do? And so he came up with this rather genius idea of this episode where they blow up the town. But it was also shocking. A lot of people were sort of horrified that he did this.
Right.
And it was hard. I remember when I initially watched it, I actually laughed. I kind of got the giggles. I went, oh, my God, he really did it. He blew it up. But I know that some people took it quite hard. Like, no, don't blow up my set.
Right. Right. That definitely was crazy. And you could never go back. You can't relive it.
I mean, that's the thing. If you say, well, we're going to do a reboot, we're going to do a thing, return to Walnut Grove, well, they done blew it up. So you're going to have to write a whole other plot line, something else going to happen, because guess we blew up the set.
Tell me a little bit about Steve Tracy and how you got involved with helping folks when it comes to HIV and AIDS.
Steve Tracy, who played my husband Percival on the show, wonderful, wonderful person, just a really great guy, great actor, so funny, and just the chemistry. I mean, trying to find the guy who's willing to come on a series that's already been running for several years,
right.
and then he has to play Nellie Olson's husband. But you're going to marry Nellie Olson. I mean, not everyone wanted to sign up for that. And here they found this guy. And he was brilliant. And the whole thing was that he was a little tiny, short Jewish guy, but he tells Nellie where she can stick it, and, you know, he stands up to Mrs. Olsen. He became a national hero overnight. So Steve was brilliant. He was tough enough to do this. And we hit it off right away. And we became such good friends. And we were friends off the set. We're having such a good time. So when he called me and told me he had AIDS, I was heartbroken. I mean, and he was so young. I was like 23, so he was just, you know, 31. It was ridiculous. And I was devastated. And I said, well, how can I help? And he said, well, I'm in a better position. As he explained, he said, you know, his mom and his sister were totally standing by him. He, you know, had some money, had some health insurance. He had friends who were helping. He said, you know, I'm not destitute, obviously, like some of these people. And I have family backing me up where many people don't. And so that's why I volunteered to AIDS Project Los Angeles and started helping a lot of the people with HIV and AIDS who had nothing, who didn't know, had not been on a TV series, and whose families were not standing by him, helping him out, and really trying to help people, and helping all the people who would call the AIDS hotline just completely terrified, you know, afraid they were going to get it off a doorknob, and back then nobody knew what they were doing. And it was really good. I was able to help a lot of people. I wound up working for an agency called Tuesday's Child, mm-hmm. which helped families with children and babies with HIV and AIDS. And that was pretty intense, but we helped a lot of people. And I'm still doing so. I mean, unfortunately, there are still people out there who are sick, who need help. I did a thing last year for the AIDS Project of the Ozarks out in Missouri. Did a fundraiser with them. Very good people. So, yes, it is because of Steve. I did that, and he died on Thanksgiving Day in 1986. Mm. And I was like 32 years old. So it was before they really had anything. I mean, if he lived a little longer, who knows? He might have gone on the cocktail and still be alive.
Sure.
But they had nothing. Oh, he was so brave. This was a guy who, when they really didn't have a lot then, they were doing some experimental treatments. And he said, oh, I'm taking the experimental treatments. And I said, oh, great. And he said, well, it's very painful. I have these injections, and this is them. And I said, this sounds awful. And he said, oh, yeah, it's horrible. And I said, well, is it going to work? Is it going to save you? He said, oh, no, it's too late for me. This won't save me.
Oh.
I said, what? He said, no, but if I let them experiment on me, they might find something that will save someone else.
Someone else, right.
And that's the kind of person he was.
And that's fantastic. These are the stories that folks don't know behind the scenes.
Right.
You know, and we may see you through that little magic box in our living room as that that little mean person who, would put Laura Ingalls through all kinds of hell.
I hate her.
But yet you're doing stuff like this. And not to mention, you're somebody who serves on the National Advisory Board of the National Association to Protect Children. Talk to us about that.
Indeed, I'm on that. And I'm also on the board of a minor consideration, which is also preventing abuse of child actors. So
right.
What happened is again, around 2003, I got a call. They're starting this thing, protect.org. And you can visit our website, protect.org, National Association to Protect Children. They're doing amazing work. I mean, you've no doubt, you've seen the stuff, you see the news, you read the papers about what's happening with child pornography and child trafficking and just unspeakable things going on. And you see, like, what was it like Jared of Subway when they came with the van
right.
and the thousands of pieces of child pornography this man had and the disgusting things he was doing? This goes on times a thousand, more than you're seeing on the news. There's thousands of Jareds out there, unfortunately. And there are people who are, in the manufacture of child porn. There's kids in the house. I mean, when the cops, the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, go out, and they see that someone is distributing and creating child pornography and they go on a raid, they not only find that the person has hundreds of thousands of videos, they then find, they walk in and there's the kid that they just saw in the video. It's in the house, and they're having to rescue these kids. It's pretty awful. And they're outgunned and underfunded and undermanned, and we're doing everything we can to help them. One of the things that we started doing at Protect is this thing, the HERO program, where veterans coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan, who may have been wounded and may not be able to go back to their old job. We've got a training program that they can sign up for, and we have trained all of these soldiers in forensics, in computer skills, and about the whole child pornography problem, and we've apprenticed them out to the ICAC teams, and several of them, many of them now, have been hired. And we've been doing this over the last couple of years, and the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, they are now getting extra manpower of these highly trained, highly motivated individuals who are already really good at hunting bad guys and are very well trained in the military, and then they go through our training as well. So we're helping cause more arrests and more investigations of child pornography and child trafficking and actually causing the rescue of these children.
You look at what's taken place over the past year. I'm not sure if you attended or if you watched last night the Golden Globes.
Right.
Give me, this is in that same conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Give me your thoughts.
Well, I'm a little jaded. You know, when the Me Too thing finally really caught up speed, although there was a woman talking about Me Too years ago before. I always say I was Me Too before when hashtag was a pound symbol. This has been going on for a long time,
right.
and women have been talking about the horrible produced and the horrible people. I mean, when I think about how in my early 20s, my father had a management company. He was my manager. My father or his partner, Jess, or someone. People were coming with me to auditions, even in my 20s, going, no, we're coming with you. I'm like, why are you coming with me? Oh, and people would call for meetings, and my father was constantly lecturing me and the other clients, there is no meeting at the hotel. There is no meeting at somebody's house. The meeting is at the office. and I sometimes would be approached at parties. Oh, I have a film coming. You should come to this thing at my house, and we'll talk. And one of my managers would, like, just pop up and go, sounds great. What time shall we meet at your office? And I got to tell you, a lot of these guys suddenly lost interest and said, no, that's okay. I was on some list of the girls who you probably don't want to start anything with because she's not coming to your house, she's not coming to your hotel room, she's not coming alone to your office, and if you try anything, she'll probably hit you. So
good for you.
I was definitely on the list of young women who would likely go, you want a what, and like probably punch you in the face. As a result, I assure you there are projects I was not called in for. If you've got 2,000 women and 1,000 of them you know might actually say yes and have sex with you, and the other 1,000 or 2,000 will say no, but they will be terrorized into submission and not tell anyone, and you can be horrible to them and send them home in tears, why are you going to call the one or two women who you know are going to tell you to go stuff it and hit you? So they don't call us. And it was absolutely, you knew there were certain people. There were a list of people that I know I never met with. I know there were people. My father, he was friends with some people who worked with Bill Cosby.
Oh, my.
And certainly had the ability to pick up the phone and call them and say, should Allison come in for a meeting about the Cosby Show? Amazingly, that never happened. It was just like, oh, no, no, we're not having a meeting with them. There were just all these people like, gee, shouldn't I be going to see them? No, really, no, that's okay. And they knew, and people knew. They didn't talk about it. No one talked about it. But people knew that there were certain producers and certain stars who had a horrible reputation and that sending your female clients was taking a horrible risk and that your female client was going to be put in a horrible position. And if you, you know, had a female client who said, no, I don't care, I'm happy to sleep with someone for the job, I guess you could say, well, you knock yourself out. But, and there were agents and managers who said, no, it's disgusting, I'm never sending any of my people to these people because I know what they're like. And they knew. And it's been going on forever. And I guess the part where I always did, I was sort of amazed that all these people actually got caught. I'm actually amazed that all of these guys, Weinstein and all of these horrible people, actually had to step down and got in trouble.
Right.
Because I'm thinking, okay, wow, his brother must have been awfully sick of him. His board of directors must have just had it with him. They must have had something on him that they were done with him anyway. Because he's been doing this for what, 20, 30 years?
Right.
And he's been harassing and torturing, and now it looks like committing out-and-out physical rape on numerous people and getting away with it and paying off lawsuits. And they all knew, and they were helping him do. So what happened that finally someone at his company said, we're not picking up the tab for this one, and finally said, you're on your own, and threw him to the wolves? Because he was doing it every day for the last couple of decades, and people knew. So one morning, they somehow woke up and said, okay, we're just not covering for him anymore, and bailed. And it all collapsed. And this seems to have happened all over town. I think it's fantastic. It's about time. As I said, time's up.
Yep.
But I don't know what the legal change was that all of these people who were being completely covered for until 5 minutes ago suddenly have no cover.
Yeah, we are speaking with New York Times bestseller, Allison Arngrim, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, How I Survived Nellie Olson and Learned to Love Being Hated. And of course, you mentioned earlier how much Melissa Gilbert loved you. Well, I believe on the cover of the book, it says, courage, moxie, chutzpah. Allison Arngrim has them all. I love this book and I love her, Melissa Gilbert.
Yeah, I did. She gave me a blurb. She loved it. When I sent her the draft before even done, and she was texting me going, okay, I just spat iced tea out across the room. I'm dying over here. She was in fits over it. So, yeah, she really liked it.
We got to wrap up this interview. It's been an awesome interview with you, but I want to give you a quick minute to – there's one more thing. Road we didn't go down yet, and that is about the new web series, Life Interrupted.
Oh my God! Go on YouTube. Look up Life Interrupted. It's hysterical. Mason Reese, the fabulous Mason Reese of the old Underwood Deviled Ham commercials.
Yep.
I play his ex-wife, I've Left Him for a Woman, played by Erin Murphy, who is Tabitha on Bewitched. My Mother is played by Dawn Wells, Marianne from Gilligan's Island. Her mother is played by Michael Learned, the mother from the Waltons.
Wow.
Everybody's in this thing. It's hysterical. We even have Robbie Rist. It's a riot.
If folks want to find out more about what you're up to, because you are a busy gal, or if you're going to be coming to the area...
And I'm going to be in New York in May, and Philadelphia as well. I come in it's the Mother's Day weekend. I like to do a Mother's Day weekend show in New York. I'm going to be in Philadelphia on the 11th, and in New York at the Laurie Beachman on the 12th and 13th.
Well, if you happen to sneak into Boston, we'd love to have you in studio if you're not doing anything.
I should, and I have performed in Boston and in P-Town and Massachusetts many, many times and have friends there. So, indeed, I should swing by. My website is bonnetheads.com, protectors, of course, protect.org, and I'm on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and everything else they make, so.
And before we go, and say hello to Hannibal and Charisse for me.
Oh, the cats.
Your cats.
Well, our dear Hannibal and our dear Clarice have finally keeled over from old age, the poor dears. Hannibal lived to be 21. Do you know how many cats do you have that are 21 years old? And Clarice made it to 20, so we have a new young cat. I guess she's 2 now. She's still such a baby. Morticia.
Ooh.
All black, gorgeous all black. She's a black Bombay, and it's like having a panther in the house. She's constantly biting us in the ankle. She's adorable, but Morticia is the new cat.
We're going to have to get a Gomez to go with that Morticia.
Right? She needs a Gomez.
She needs a Gomez. Allison, thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You got it. This she is. All Allison right. Ingram, our guest here. And folks, that's all the time that we blabbed our way through another Monday Night Talk. We hope you enjoyed it. And Larry, did you enjoy it? I think Larry did. He's shaking his head. He looks like he did.
Very enjoyable tonight, yeah.
Yeah, good. All right. Yeah, so I get it like a B-plus tonight?
B-plus tonight, just tonight.
All right. So that's all the time we have here until next week at 6:15 p.m. Have yourself a great night.
The South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. 95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com.